Good afternoon and welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host today, Beth Werner. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU, brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Today we have two special guests, and we're going to be talking to two women who recently graduated from the master's program at Humboldt State. We're going to be talking about both of their theses. And to start us off is Vanessa Vasquez. She is a staff member at Humboldt Baykeeper and recently received an MA through the Environment and Community Program in HSU. Welcome, Vanessa.
Good afternoon, Beth.
So, first off, congratulations. That's got to be really exciting.
Thank you. Yes, very exciting.
I think that, well, I'm really lucky because I got to go see you defend your thesis, but I thought it was a really interesting topic that everyone who's listening can kind of listen to and think, oh, well, you know, this is maybe not such a difficult process to move Arcata forward. So why don't you give us a little bit of background on what you did your thesis on?
Sure. My project title is Edible Arcata, a GIS perspective for a local food-loving community in Humboldt County. And I looked around Arcata and kind of thought to myself, I see a lot of edible plants and vegetable gardens in front yards, but I don't see too many edible plants growing on public-owned property. Like the plaza, for example, has some artichoke plants and a lemon tree, but the other parks around town don't have edible plants. And I was thinking, you know, this is a potential resource that the city of Arcata isn't using. So I started looking around at other communities across the United States to see if what they're doing in urban agriculture and edible landscaping on public property. And I found that there's many cities that are going ahead and moving forward with putting vegetable gardens and edible landscaping plants in their public parks. So I went to the city of Arcata and I looked at some of their planning documents and talked to some of their staff and city council members and found out that the city of Arcata has a 2011-2012 city council goal to start incorporating edible plants into their landscaping and management practices. So I took the 2011-2012 goal and created a GIS project. I use Geographic Information Systems, which is a computer mapping program, and I found sites in Arcata that I deemed suitable for edible landscaping.
What a great find. So that means that you were able to go look at their goals and kind of see how they could maybe best approach their goals.
Yes, that's correct. I wanted to create a project that would be useful for the local community.
I think that's really ideal. I think a lot of us think of really great projects and then we think, oh, you know, what's going to happen with what we do? And I think that's a really great idea. So just to kind of step back, when we're thinking about edible landscapes in Arcata, what is a landscape in Arcata that you were looking at? What types of landscapes?
I was looking for sites that were on public property and that were accessible to people, so they needed to be near roads or trails, and also areas that didn't have sensitive habitat, so I excluded wetlands or areas with streams. And I also looked for areas that are potentially in low-income neighborhoods.
What kind of plants, when you say edible landscaping, are you thinking of anything edible or specifically something that's native to the area? What kind of plants are on your list?
Well, I did some interviews with some local experts, both native plant experts and people involved in urban agriculture, and I ended up creating a list of recommended plants. Most of the edible plants that I deemed as useful or I said were recommended are plants that are hardy or perennial and suited to the local environment. So there's several native berries that would be great edible landscaping plants. Also, there's several different varieties of fruit trees that do well here, and then plants like artichokes and herbs, kale.
Oh, okay. So when you have a public landscape that has edible food on it, I mean, the concept sounds great, but who is responsible for taking care of that landscape, and then who gets to benefit from it?
That's a really good question, and that's where I look to other cities to see how they're managing these foodscapes. And it seems that it works best if it's a combination of city-sponsored where there's actually a program in place where city staff are working on these foodscapes, but also a combination of community support. So a local group that would be helping with the maintenance and management. In Sebastopol, California, for example, they have an Adopt a Landscape program where local groups, individuals, or businesses can kind of adopt an area, and then they kind of pay for the management and plant the plants. But it's a city-sponsored program that's supported, and the city has a recommended plant list of plants they would like to see in those areas.
Oh, wow. Okay, so Sebastopol's doing it in California. Are there other groups on the West Coast or cities that are doing that?
Yeah, definitely. Oakland is really moving forward with increasing their local food production within the city. They have a really progressive urban agriculture sponsored program. There's also Portland, Oregon, which is one of the more progressive cities in local food and urban agriculture policy. They have several projects that they're working on. They have a community orchard that's sponsored by the city. They have a food garden at their city hall, which, you know, we're seeing popping up all over the U.S., including on the White House.
Certainly. Michelle Obama, I remember when she did that, that was a pretty big deal for everyone. So what originally got you interested in edible landscaping as far as, you know, really studying this for your master's?
I've been involved in the local food community here. I've volunteered for a community alliance with family farmers for a couple years, and I am an avid foodie. I love to go to local food potlucks, and I got really inspired seeing what people were bringing to these potlucks, stuff that they had harvested themselves and had, you know, walked around town and picked blackberries and made a pie out of it, or gone up to the forest and picked nettles. So that was kind of the initial inspiration, was just like looking around and seeing that we do have this local food loving community, and there is food already on the landscape. But then I'm from Chico, California, and it's an agriculture community as well, and there's a lot more fruit trees around town. And I kind of missed that when I moved here. There are lots of edible berries, but I didn't really see many fruit trees. And so I thought, you know, this is an area that we have a great climate for growing food, and it just seems that we could have more food on our landscape, and it would really help our sustainability and self-reliance.
Certainly, given the local food movement, how strong it is, both with, you know, people within this generation, but also within this community, I think that this could be a really good fit for Arcata. When you were looking at available sites in Arcata, were you impressed, or were you thinking maybe we could do better? What was your take on the results from your project?
I think that there's a lot of sites that are suitable. The GIS model that I created selected a lot of sites, almost all of the parks and kind of the downtown area. The community center area has a lot of parks that I think would be suitable. If I was to continue this research, is I would also look for, I didn't consider irrigation. And so some of these sites might be hard to establish at first if they don't have access to water. But we definitely have a really good growing climate, and we have good soil in Arcata. So I think many of our parks that are currently have lawns would be great places to put a couple of fruit trees or a berry patch or some vegetables.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. And I think it would teach people, you know, a lot more about where your food's coming from, which is a really important lesson, because once you start thinking about where your food's coming from, you start thinking about where's your water coming from, and where does your waste go, and, you know, maybe you have a real connection to your home and why the resources that you're using are available or not available to you. I think this is a really good educational tool, beyond being wonderful for the benefit of the bounty of food that you can get.
Yeah, I definitely looked at it as, I believe that when we care about our piece of land, then that kind of extends out further. And if we see our public space as usable and accessible, then we'll care more about our community overall. I think that the lawn at the Arcata City Hall would be an excellent site, both for education and for inspiring other people to foodscape in their own yards.
This might be a silly question, but I have chickens, so I'm curious, does the edible agriculture extend to keeping animals? Is that an option?
Definitely. I mean, I don't know what the regulations are and the ordinances in Arcata are, but I do know many people keep chickens in the city, so I think that that's okay. But one of the cities that I looked at in my thesis was Burlingame, Vermont, and they have many ordinances that support livestock as part of their urban agriculture policy in their city.
Well, that's really interesting. When you put together your final result and kind of got a chance to step back and look at it and think, you know, maybe this is a possibility, do you feel encouraged that if you have already spoken with the city council or if you will speak with them or the staff at Arcata City, do you feel like maybe something positive can come from this as far as development in actually securing edible agriculture within public spaces?
I hope so. The city, everybody that I spoke to and interviewed during my research was very supportive and encouraging for me to do this work. And they all have been very enthusiastic about seeing the final document, which I'm going to be providing them with this week. It's finally all edited and ready to go out. So I look forward to meeting with them and see, you know, if we can achieve this goal, help them move forward with increasing edible plants on the public space in Arcata, and then also hopefully meet with other groups in the area, nonprofits and gardening groups that would like to help work with the city as well.
I think that's a great idea. When you were, you know, moving forward on your thesis, were there other students that you communicated with through different schools that are doing this? I mean, it's such a, well, specific to Arcata, of course, but it seems like a project that can be then replicated for other areas. So it's not necessarily specific to Arcata in that this can happen anywhere.
Yeah, I definitely looked at a project that was done through the University of Oregon. There was a local food survey that was done using GIS, and I really used that research paper to kind of replicated some of their methodology when I was doing my GIS portion of my project. And I contacted those students and we interacted. We sent many email exchanges. So there's definitely other students that are working on urban agriculture projects and GIS, using GIS in urban agriculture to develop policy and management practices it's growing.
Well, I'm really glad that you got to do that. Certainly the community is going to benefit from your work, so we really appreciate it. And again, congratulations. I know how hard you were working on that, and I look forward to seeing something happen in Arcata and hopefully beyond.
Thank you.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Eco News Report. My name is Beth Werner, and I've been your host for the past 15 minutes. Today's a special Eco News because we actually have a new guest right now. We're talking about local masters, actually. They just graduated from the master's program at Humboldt State University. And my next guest is Iris Koski, and she just got her MS from the Environmental Science and Management program at HSU. Welcome, Iris. How are you doing?
Hi, Beth. It's great to be here.
Oh, good. Well, as I recall talking to you, you were telling me about your project, and it was really interesting because it deals with a landscape that is, I want to say, mismanaged, but maybe could be better managed. Well, you'll actually tell us your opinion. I'm very curious to learn more about it, but also the relationship between private property and public property and restoration work. So please tell us a little bit about what you did your thesis on.
Thanks, Beth. Yeah, I was really interested in kind of the differences in management between public lands and private lands. And I wanted to choose a project that really highlighted these issues. And I started researching these differences, and I realized that certain habitats are very spatially restricted to the private landscape, meaning that policies that are created to conserve these habitats aren't necessarily going to carry over to the private landscape. And one habitat type that really stood out in this was oak woodlands. And oak woodlands are extremely important. They are the most biodiverse habitat in the United States.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah. And my study area is the Klamath-Siskiyou bioregion, so Northern California and Southern Oregon. And what we see here is over 200 species of terrestrial vertebrates, as well as a bunch of different anadromous fish and huge breeding grounds for songbirds. So I was I got into this project actually looking first at songbirds and then realized I was very fascinated with this habitat type. So I wanted to try to figure out what exactly is going on and investigate further the relationship between private lands and oak woodlands. And what I found is that overall, there's only 10% of the original range of oak woodlands left.
And
wow. Over 80% of those are occurring on private lands. So this led me to conclude that kind of the future of oak woodlands is largely, if not dominantly, in the hands of private landowners. So I wanted to see what's going on and if they're doing anything to conserve these really critical resources.
So when we're thinking of an oak woodland, are we thinking of like the rolling hills with the oak trees on them? Is that kind of the idea of what we're looking at?
Yeah, I included several different species within my study design. The first one is white oak, Oregon white oak. It's kind of the hallmark species when you think oak woodland in this region. Like you were saying, open rolling savannas, grassland with large legacy trees. And then I also included black oak and live oak, and also even tan oak, because they're very regionally distinct and important, and they produce a huge acorn crop, which is really critical for wildlife, and also was super critical for native cultures.
Certainly.
For the last 10,000, 12,000 years.
How did you begin this project, just having the conversation with the private landowners and kind of introducing this project to them?
You know, I was really lucky to be invited to many different private lands before I even began the field work for this project, conducting restoration work. So going out on prescribed burns and helping landowners prune and thin their conifers, which are encroaching on oak woodlands and causing them to be in huge decline. And I also had some wonderful opportunities to participate in bird surveys on private lands throughout the Klamath Basin, and really solidifying my theory that oak woodlands are critical for wildlife. I found far more diversity and abundance of songbird species within oak woodland habitats than anywhere else.
Well, a lot of our listeners are bird watchers, and Godwit Days was just, I don't know, a couple months ago, we'll say. And a lot of people travel to this area because of the diversity of species, but you're saying there's lots of diversity of songbirds in oak woodland habitats. Is that because of the nesting? I mean, what's that relationship there?
You know, there's a lot of different things going on that make oak woodlands really unique.
Mm-hmm.
They are extremely diverse. So the plant compositions in an oak woodland are far more diverse than you would find in like an average coniferous forest. So most birders know if you want to go see 100 species in one day or something, you don't go to Redwood National Park. You go up to the Bald Hills and you'll find way more diversity up there. And it has to do a lot too with edge to interior ratios. So oak woodlands tend to encompass a huge variety of adjacent habitats, which then allow different bird species to fly through foraging and nesting.
Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. So when you were beginning this project, what kind of indicators were you looking for as far as the importance of oak woodlands? You know, you said as far as they relate to birds, but also, I mean, what kind of relationship do they have with the fish species that you were talking about?
So the different Some streams are year-round and some streams are ephemeral. And there are...
Can you clarify what ephemeral is?
Ephemeral is like it runs during the rainy periods. So, you know, spring and winter mainly. And certain fish use these streams as passageways for their migration up into larger water courses.
Oh, okay. So when you were looking at how these are protected, you know, what happened? You said if only 10% are left, essentially. Was it encroachment by growth? Was it encroachment by other issues? Like, what got us to where we are today?
So, the jury is still kind of out in terms of the actual needs, ecological needs for oak trees. But two main things kind of really stand out, and they're very related. The first is conifer encroachment. Oak trees are highly shade intolerant. So as coniferous trees, seedlings grow up around oak trees. If they're not managed or cleared, the oak trees will become really unhealthy and ultimately succumb and secede to a different habitat type, mostly Douglas fir or Western juniper. The second really critical thing going on the landscape that we're seeing is wide-scale fire suppression. And a lot of oak trees are serotonous, meaning they require the presence of fire to release their acorns and reseed. In the absence of fire, they are not able to regenerate. And what we're seeing is almost complete lack of regeneration on the landscape.
Oh, wow.
Compared to 100 years ago.
So looking at this project, what did you find as far as opportunities to protect and then maybe grow these landscapes?
Well, I found some really interesting opportunities that are kind of specific to our region. We are really lucky to have a population in this area of Northern California of people who are very concerned about and very literate about natural and prescribed fire, the importance of fire on the landscape ecologically, and also the importance of maintaining fire-safe perimeters around their houses and on their properties. And so this is actually, even if the landowners aren't necessarily considering the effects that they'll have on their oak trees, this ends up being a huge benefit. Clearing ladder fuels and encroaching conifers around home sites and on properties, that has two benefits. One is to make the property far more fire safe should a fire event occur on their property. And the second is that it releases the oaks from competition from conifers and allows them to grow in their natural structure.
That's really interesting. Now that you have completed, and congratulations, I didn't say congratulations.
Thank you. It's great to be done.
Yeah, I'm sure. As far as the completion of this project, what do you see as the next step?
Well, I'm really excited to be beginning some work with some local capacity building organizations regarding kind of three goals that can all be achieved together, which is oak woodland management, fire safe properties, and wildlife habitat creation. So those are all things that can simultaneously be achieved. And so I'm really excited to participate in this kind of research and implementation of the research. And then I'm also going to be going down to UC Davis. I'm actually leaving in half an hour. And I'm going to be presenting this research for the Society for Ecological Restoration.
Oh, wonderful. And do they speak about oak woodlands, or they talk about something larger and this is specific to that?
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, there's a bunch of different sections of this conference, and I, of course, will be in the oak woodland section. It's become such a huge issue in our state that there's now a growing body of research dedicated just to this. So I'll be speaking in the section of the conference dedicated to oak woodlands.
This might be a strange question, but I'm just curious because I don't know much about this topic, but I'm very interested. So for someone like me, say I'm a private landowner and this project can benefit me. Does part of your project come with some sort of education materials for me so I know what to do? Or is that maybe like a next further step as far as what kind of outreach you can do to help people manage their properties more correctly?
I would love to create a resource that's very user-friendly and geared specifically towards landowners so that they can walk around their properties and note the different oak species that are present, or note the species that they would like to have present. Also, the species of wildlife they may be interested in attracting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to create a resource that is a guide for them on how to do this, how to manage their existing oaks, how to plant new ones, how to attract the wildlife that they'd like to see on their property.
Yeah, it'd be a great tool for people, you know, like I said, myself, who don't really know a lot about the landscape as far as, you know, what's a rare tree or not, and how I can better protect that land. I don't own any land, but if I did.
Right. And what I found in my research is that landowners love their oak trees. They may not necessarily know much about them. They may not necessarily know their specific management requirements, but it's a very iconic tree on the landscape, and it's very culturally relevant and also has been used by indigenous and non-indigenous cultures for thousands of years all around the world. Oak trees have been super important for building material, firewood, you know, so much fuel. There's so many things that are so critical. So I'd love to help landowners know just a little bit more.
Certainly.
About how what they need.
Well, I know that the acorn is a really important part of native tradition here, and so I imagine that the ties between the oak woodlands and the native people here is just very,
very
deep.
Strong.
Yeah, certainly.
Very, very strong.
So what would you do differently to kind of, now that you're done, to maybe move your project in a different way or to help yourself or maybe to find a different result? What would you do differently or what would you change?
You know, I did take on a lot for this project. My study area was gigantic, over 12,000 square miles. So I attempted to describe a region that's extremely large and extremely complex. And I think I might have overshot my goal of doing this, given that I only had about a year to complete my fieldwork and write up my thesis. So I think in future times I might concentrate my fieldwork more in one area and really give a more thorough description of one area rather than try to encompass such a huge region in one small research project.
Certainly. That's always hard for the initial, you want to start big, that scope, you just get so excited and then you realize, but I want to do more than I can, or, you know, that trade-off between being specific or having this great database, it's always
tough. Know, all my professors that throughout grad school encouraged me to try to think a little bit smaller and really hone my project down to a more finite thing, and I just didn't want to do that. I like to think on the landscape scale, so I did come up with some really interesting results that I'm excited to share, but I also realized that there could be a lot more done within specific communities and regions in this basin.
Well, maybe it could turn into a PhD project at some
point.
I'm
never going back to school, thanks.
Well, fair enough. Well, I wanted to thank you so much for coming, and we really appreciate getting to know what some of the students are doing in town, and I think that that's part of why we love this community so much. So thank you, ladies, very much for coming and sharing what you did. We really learned a lot today. Thank you. This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Beth Werner, and I've been your host for the past half hour. My guests today have been Vanessa Vasquez and Iris Koski, and they've been talking about their master thesis. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on KHSU's website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Previous shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at urnec.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for engineering. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.